Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder that we are Zooming on Tuesday afternoon, so if Donald Trump should do something Tuesday night, we'll probably not be discussing it till the end of the week. As you've come to expect, every single day since March, we have begun this show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I suspect that by now, October, you have it committed to memory, and that's a good thing, because I want his voice ringing in your ear when you decide to exercise the franchise, as many of you have already begun to do. We will continue to play this testimony during the impeachment hearings between now and the election of 2020 that ends sometime in November. I'm not quite sure when. Again, the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, a patriot, someone willing to talk truth to power, and someone who you need to sort of reflect his courage as you decide to vote this November.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I was reading Slate magazine. And as I was reading Slate magazine, everyone, I saw a name that I recognized. David Ganz is the director of the Human Rights, Civil Rights, and Citizenship Program at the Constitutional Accountability Center. It is a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to fulfilling the progressive promise of our Constitution's text and history. Boy, he's got to be working overtime. We work in our courts, through our government, and with legal scholars to preserve the rights and freedoms of all Americans and to protect our judiciary from politics and special interests. The article that David wrote was entitled, How John Roberts Quietly Made It Harder to Vote. And I want to welcome David to the program. And it is such a depressing article that you wrote, David, because as I was reading it, I began to realize that they are now an accomplice to the GOP in suppressing the vote. And how sad is that? Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Arnie. I mean, so there's no right protected by more parts of the Constitution than the right to vote, but the Roberts Court refuses to protect that right when it matters most, right at election day and right before the election day. We saw this play out last night in the case out of South Carolina, in that there was an order issued last night that blocked a lower court order that had sought to protect the right to vote by saying, in the context of the pandemic, you can't impose a requirement that mail-in ballot must be signed by a witness. And the Roberts Court said, we're going to put a stay, we're going to stop that order from going into effect so that South Carolina can enforce that in the context of the election. And one of the things that you have to understand about orders like this, so you're used to the big Supreme Court cases that we hear about that are briefed, they're argued, lots of parties file briefs as friend of the court deliberates often for months. These orders that we're seeing, and this is only the latest, we've been seeing them all throughout the 2020 election season, beginning in Wisconsin, when the court left voters in Milwaukee with only five polling places. And in these cases, they're decided very quickly, very hastily. The court doesn't hear oral argument. They hear very limited briefing. And in time and time again, the Roberts Court has said, we're not going to protect the right to vote when it's close to an election day, which is when the right to vote matters most.
So David, I'm ignorant here. So tell me, how do they make a decision when they're going to have a full-fledged hearing where, you know, you get to hear the parties, they have to sort of deliberate and yada, yada. And when do they decide that they can do these things that, you know, have no signature, come with no sort of, you know, public understanding of how they got to this decision, and yet it has the full force and effect of a Supreme Court decision?
Right. So there's really two parts of the work the Supreme Court does. And we're very focused on the merits cases, the cases that the court chooses to hear and decide fully and give a full opinion that explains the reasoning. And then there is a separate part of the Supreme Court's work that is often called the shadow docket, because it operates in the shadows. That was the part of the Slate article that said, this is something that's being quietly done that is escaped attention. And, you know, now it's getting much more attention because we see the Supreme Court intervening in all sorts of ways over the last few months in a way that undercuts our democracy.
So let me just read something to my audience, because I'm going to go from your Slate article, because I want them to understand the extent of this shadow docket and why they need to pay attention. You write at the very beginning of your Slate article, there are 250 COVID-related election cases making their way through the nation's state and federal courts. The Supreme Court, which lost one of its greatest defenders of the right to vote with the tragic passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is poised to issue critically important orders in voting right cases in the weeks to come that could affect whether your vote is counted. And as I'm reading this and I'm hearing you, are these cases that eventually get to the court, are all of them going to be kind of a slam dunk shadow court decisions?
Well, so the shadow docket exists because they're often litigants come to the Supreme Court saying, there's an emergency, I need you to give relief to stay a lower court ruling. And the Supreme Court, their shadow docket exists because rulings need to be made on an emergency basis. And since the beginning of the Roberts Court, they have essentially created this doctrine that says stay orders will be regularly granted close to election to prevent rulings that protect the right to vote. And this is really rewritten the law that was in place long before. And in the Slate piece I talk about, if you go back decades to how the court operated, they recognized protecting the right to vote and protecting our democracy was critical right before the election. And they both considered the state's interest in orderly administration, as well as the necessity of protecting the right to vote. And there are many sort of past precedents where they said, we're going to make sure that the voters have a fulsome opportunity to vote for the candidate of their choice. Sometimes they added third parties who were kept off the ballot back onto the ballot, very close to the election. Sometimes they prevented states from employing discriminatory voting schemes, recognizing that right before the election is the critical time for protecting the right to vote. And one of the things that you have to understand is, you know, once a voter has their vote suppressed, you can't unring the bell. That is a sort of a permanent deprivation that denies you kind of one of your most fundamental, one of your most cherished rights, which is the right to participate in our democracy. So the court is really sort of turning its back on a critical part of our Constitution, and they're doing it
clandestinely.
Right, they're doing it without fully hearing arguments. And, you know, voting rights cases are often, there are often a lot of important details. There's a lot of complexity. And when they shortchange the process, they often get it wrong. And they're consistently getting it wrong in a way that undercuts the fundamental right to vote.
So you mentioned what was decided last night. So I went to BuzzFeed News, because you had not yet written about this at Slate. And please don't be offended by this, but I want to read a little of this article, because it really sort of helps to flesh out exactly what you're saying. And at BuzzFeed, the title was, "The Supreme Court Warned Against Changing Voting Rules Near Election Day. And then they did it anyway." I love her headline, because it was like she had read your Slate article, and then the headline almost comes from your Slate article. And she writes, "The justices reinstated South Carolina's requirement that absentee voters have a witness sign their ballot. Senator Lindsey Graham is in a close race in South Carolina. And the part that makes me apoplectic is that there was a lower court that said, you know, because of the pandemic, because it is so difficult, they had a full-blown hearing on this. We really don't want you to have a witness. You can just send it in without a witness. And there's really been very little suggestion that there's anything in the way of fraud. So people have already started doing this, David, in South Carolina. They already sent in their ballot. They didn't have it witnessed. All of this was going forward. And then, of course, the challenge was then moved up to the Supreme Court. And as you point out, in their shadow docket, that didn't have a full-blown hearing, that didn't hear all the things, frankly, that the federal court below was able to hear, they then decided that they would reinstate the idea of having a witness. And they've had to sort of like split the baby. And so they're saying, okay, this decision came down after the other decision. So if you already sent it in without the witness, you're good to go. And now after our decision, you're going to have to get a witness. So what the frick is the point of the witness anyway, David? If you got in early and you don't need it, and you get in late and now you do need it, then the witness is a sham. It's not really meaningful.
I mean, so I think the important thing to pay attention to is the state said, and three justices on the Supreme Court agreed, that was Justice Gorsuch, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito said, even ballots that didn't have a witness that were cast previously when the court had said no witness requirement was necessary, those three justices said those should be thrown out too.
Oh my God, sorry.
And the court, the court's order didn't go that far. The court said any ballots previously received and any ballots received in the following 2 days from the date of last night's order will still count, even though they didn't have the witness requirement. So the court, so as the article pointed out, you know, the court is saying, well, we shouldn't insert ourselves at the last minute, but they are inserting themselves in a way that undercuts our democracy and, you know, imposes this arbitrary deadline that they've invented, that it's got to be received within 2 days. So if you've, you know, if you, before the court order issued its order, if you had sent in your mail-in ballot without a witness, consistent with what the lower court had mandated, if it arrives 3 days later under the Supreme Court's order, your ballot will be counted, will not count. So the court is
talk about chaos, David. So I'm looking at the article at BuzzFeed, and I just want people to know, part of this is you shouldn't make changes just before an election. It could create confusion and chaos, right? That's part of the je ne sais quoi of why they make these decisions. So let me just read you the chaos they have created in South Carolina. So as you point out, they decided South Carolina would have to count ballots received in the next 2 days that lacked a witness signature. But the state could enforce the rule and reject ballots without a witness signature if they came in after that, right? Now here's the chaos in South Carolina. State election officials quickly posted an announcement about the change on the state's voter information website and tweeted about it on Tuesday, that's today. Just over a week earlier, the state's election commission tweeted out that there was no witness requirement due to court orders, but cautioned that could change. I mean, this is the most chaotic election. And David, throw in the fear of the pandemic. Throw that in an election that's now incredibly contested in Lindsey Graham's election. And I am looking at the fact that we know that Donald Trump is now sort of an instigator of chaos, but I am looking at the Supreme Court basically being appendage to that chaos and creating chaos in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fundamental problem is they're so focused on we don't want any changes that they are missing the ways that it's shortchanging our democracy and making it harder for people to vote.
So maybe I'm naive here. Do they know about the pandemic? Do they think that there's a problem with the pandemic and that the pandemic has actually altered how people view standing on lines, you know, being a volunteer, collecting ballots, all those things? The consequence of the pandemic is not just illness, it is potential death. And we are looking at situations where you might be, you know, put in a room where, you're close together and you can't socially distance. How can the court not take judicial notice of the environment that we are in, given this election, and that it's supposed to be getting worse in the fall? And I am trying to figure out, how can they separate what is happening in this environment and their cling to this idea that we can change the rules just before an election when the pandemic has changed everything?
Right. I mean, I think, so one, you have to look back at the ruling they issued in April in Wisconsin, where they effectively forced voters to choose between protecting their health and exercising their fundamental right to vote. And as my Slate piece sort of talks about, the consequences were felt hardest in communities of color in Milwaukee, where they previously had 180 polling places. They were left with five, and the lines were incredibly long, and voters were forced to gather in close proximity. And the court, turned a blind eye to that. And I think, the other point that you have to remember is, this is a court that has repeatedly turned its back on the fundamental right to vote. And, you have to first understand, in 2013, the Roberts Court decided a case called Shelby County versus Holder, which gutted the Voting Rights Act and eliminated one of our strongest protections against racial discrimination in voting. And the law that was gutted by the court, it said, in jurisdictions like South Carolina and others that have a long history of racial discrimination in voting, you need pre-approval when you change your voting laws.
Right.
And if you don't, they can't be enforced. So the Roberts Court gutted that. What was left was, well, if that's not enforced, voters have to go to court and insist, court, give me relief so that I can exercise my constitutional right to vote. And now through the shadow docket orders, they're gutting that and making it hard for voters to get any remedy. So this is a court that is turning a blind eye to, as I said at the outset, one of our most fundamental constitutional rights, the one that is protected by more parts of the Constitution than any other right.
So it's interesting. I that has now been born into my brain, because when I posted the story about what the Supreme Court just did in South Carolina, I took that from you and I wrote, the Supreme Court is an accomplice to voter suppression. How pathetic. The fundamental right to vote, a right protected by more parts of the Constitution than any other right. And David, yesterday we had John Nichols on the air with us of The Nation magazine. And I want to share something that I've shared with my audience in the past, but it really does talk to what a reversal this court is based on what we have done since 1776. And what John Nichols does is he goes into a large room where there are maybe a couple of hundred people to give a talk. And he has, David, everybody stand up. And then he tells people, he says, all the women sit down. All the renters sit down. All the people of color, Asian, blah, whatever, sit down. All the Catholics and the Jews. And he goes to this whole list. And then by the time he gets done, there's like 12 old white men standing. And he looks at those 12 old white men, the property owners, the Protestants, whatever. He goes, that's originally the only folks that could vote in this country. And he goes, and since 1776, it's been a long slog, but we have expanded the franchise. We have made it more and more possible for more and more people to be able to participate in this democracy. And I feel like, as I read your piece at Slate about how the John Roberts Court is quietly making it harder to vote, after I read the decision, the bizarre decision that came down last night about South Carolina, I feel like it's where everything is going into reverse. Between economic justice, between the embrace of voting rights, all these things are moving backwards. So before I let you go, David, what can a different Congress do so that, despite the fact that the Supremes may be controlled by conservative, reactionary, anti-voting, pro-corporate members, that we can then at least assure that they can't undo because Congress has weighed in?
I mean, so Congress has does have broad powers to protect the right to vote. Congress has powers to regulate federal elections, and they can have the final say over over state election rules. Congress has the power under each of the voting rights amendments that are part of the Constitution to enforce that right to vote and make it real. There were efforts to fix the and respond to the decision in Shelby County, which passed the House in this Congress, but were stalled in the Senate. So there are powers that Congress has to protect the right to vote that people are pushing for and that are an important part of the conversation.
So David, I want you to write another article for Slate. Here, I'm giving you an assignment. And given what just happened in South Carolina and what we saw happen in Wisconsin and what we saw happen here, in a way, tell the terrible story and then show us a law that would address that story so that people can understand that elections have consequences directly to whether you get to exercise the franchise. Because, you know, if it's not another pandemic, it will be climate change. It will be a fire. It will be a flood. It will be something else. And in the end, what you want to do is make sure you want to protect the integrity of the vote. I get that. But at the same time, the word integrity should not actually be the same as suppression. And that's ultimately what the Republicans do, is they hide behind that word as that they're somehow worried about fraud. No. They're worried about voting is what they're worried about. And I would love it if people could understand that, you know, they may be in despair with who's going to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They may be despair with what the Roberts Court is going to eventually look like. But I think they need to know that we don't necessarily have to worry about getting to the Supremes if Congress can actually write laws with teeth that address some of these issues that are going to be leading up to the 250 COVID-related election cases that are sort of working their way through the court, you know, just before one of the most important elections of our lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in many ways, the Supreme Court is on the ballot, and the question is, you know, who will be choosing future nominees and what will be the direction of the Supreme Court? And so in many ways, kind of the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg is something that we all can think about, and, you know, sort of her passionate struggles for justice and equality and protecting the right to vote. You know, it's she had many great legacies, but one of her, most important legacies was in these voting rights cases. In the Shelby County case I mentioned, she wrote a brilliant dissent that, you know, took the court to task for ignoring that the Constitution gives Congress the power to protect the right to vote. In many of these cases involving shadow docket orders, denying protection for the right to vote, she wrote very strongly worded dissenting opinions. You know, there was a case back in Wisconsin that I mentioned back in April where she said, you know, what should be most important is ensuring protection for the right to vote. And so
it's, what's interesting to me is that the organization that you're the director of, the Human Rights, Civil Rights, and Citizenship Program at the Constitutional Accountability Center, is that you're also not just looking at the issue of voting rights, but that you want to, I'm going to read this last line, protect our judiciary from politics and special interests. And what is so fascinating to me, David, is that here we have a court that is so concerned about making changes in voting just before an election. But we're about to change a court before an election where people are already in the process of voting. And we know that the president nominates and then Congress, you know, approves. But isn't it interesting when it comes to voting? Oh, my God, we can't touch it. You know, we there's too much chaos. We can't do this. But then they're actually being played as political pawns here, because I don't know if you just saw this, but Donald Trump just tweeted out that there will be no other financial package coming out of this Congress or out of his administration until after the election, because he wants everything focused on getting Amy on the bench. It's, I mean, again, almost the inconsistency of the moment where the court is actually being changed during a very provocative and precarious time that adds to the chaos, as they're claiming they don't want to add to the chaos, which is why they're not going to protect the vote, because it's between now and too close to the election. The hypocrisy, here we have, you know, this, you know, too close to the election, but we're going to appoint a Supreme Court justice, but we're too close to the election and we're not going to protect the vote.
Well, I mean, I think, and the most troubling thing is we hear from the president that he needs to rush Judge Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court so that she can rule for him and throw the election to him.
Yeah.
Yes.
In the litigation that he expects will follow the election, which is very troubling and sort of puts an aura of illegitimacy over the whole process.
So I only have a minute left. I'm kind of curious. You mentioned that three of the justices last night basically wanted all the votes in South Carolina to be thrown out if they didn't have a witness. But obviously Justice Roberts sided with the other three and said, no, we can't do that, right? And so how does Justice Roberts look at this bench? I mean, he used to be torn and sometimes seemed to side with the more progressive wing of the bench, but now it's going to be so overwhelmingly conservative. My understanding is he's going to have to sort of work more with the conservatives to maybe sort of tap them down a little and not give anything to the progressives on the bench because the numbers just don't work.
Well, he's never been torn when it comes to voting rights. He has been always very much on the side of power, even when it means suppressing the right to vote. He was the one who wrote the opinion that gutted the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County. So he's very, very conservative when it comes to the right to vote and very disposed to uphold voter suppression measures and limit the power of Congress to protect the right to vote.
We've got to change the Senate. We've got to change the Senate. We've got to change the Senate. David Ganz, thank you very much. He writes for us. He was writing for Slate.com, how John Roberts quietly made it harder to vote. And the good news is we're not so quiet on the attitude, David. So we'll make sure that everybody not only reads your article, but that they are aware of what he is doing. He definitely is, in this situation, an accomplice to the Republicans who look at the vote with a jaundiced eye and want to suppress the vote. David Ganz, thank you so much for joining us. And David is with the Constitutional Accountability Center. We'll talk again.
Thanks so much, Arne.
You're welcome. This is The Attitude with Arne Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arne Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's been all bad news all the time. That's all we're doing. We're appalled at Donald Trump's behavior. We're looking at the suppression of the vote. We're seeing the pandemic roaring back. We're seeing people unemployed and underemployed. We just heard that Donald Trump does not want to see Congress come down with another bailout for people who are starving on food lines and small businesses that are going to be shutting their doors and going into bankruptcy. I can't bear it. But for whatever reason, I decided that I needed to focus on something positive. And the thing positive I'm focusing on is Pope Francis's new encyclical. The more I read about it, the more I started to smile, because it's something almost I could write. And I want to welcome my guest to the program. Kate Ward is a scholar of Christian ethics. Her research focuses on economic ethics, virtue ethics, and ethical method. She teaches at Marquette. She has published articles on wealth, virtue, and economic inequality. Boy, I love you. And as I'm looking at, she graduated from Harvard College. She got her MDiv in Bible from Catholic Theological Union in 2011. But the part that really made me smile and chuckle was that she worked for ASME, Council 31, as a labor union organizing workers in Catholic healthcare settings. So I want to welcome my sister, Kate Ward, to the program. What you don't know about me, Kate, is that I was a religion major. Oh. I was on my way to divinity school. And at the last minute, and I had wanted to be a minister from the time I was 11 years old. And here I was suddenly finishing up my undergraduate degree with a religion major, political science and urban affairs, on my way, filling out applications for divinity school. And at the last minute, I went to work for a church. Guess where? In Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
No.
Wait a minute. A Lutheran church. And I worked for something called the Next Door Foundation. And I worked for this organization, and it was associated with the Lutheran Church Next Door. And all of a sudden, I realized, I'm not sure I wanted to be in the comfortable pew, but I wanted to do social work. I wanted to work with people who really had a need. And as a result, at that sort of experience, technically working with the church, was when I decided not to pursue my master's in divinity. And I ended up getting a law degree, and I ended up working for a poverty agency, and the rest is history. So as I'm reading your stuff, don't be surprised that I would look at this encyclical. Kate, let's talk about this third encyclical, because my understanding is kind of like a trisecta. It's like this is the third one. Mm-hmm. And this one seems to be a composite of his other two and maybe some of the other things he's done. But it is incredibly important. It is very long. And it touches on so many issues that we're facing because of the economic inequality, because of climate change. And my understanding is that he started writing this even before the pandemic, mm-hmm. but in some ways the pandemic put an exclamation point on this encyclical. So welcome to the program, and teach my audience about this really, really powerful and frankly, I think incredibly progressive piece of writing.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. And now I have something I can tell my students about a potential career path if you have a theology major. So I've duly filed that away. Thank you. I love that you started out by framing the encyclical as a ray of hope in this world. That's exactly how I felt when I read it. So for those who aren't familiar, encyclicals are less like legislation than maybe kind of a State of the Union address where the Pope might say, here's what's going on in the world, the good and the bad, and really try and lay out a vision, drawing on shared principles and shared goals for how we can work together to address what's going on in the world. And there's been this formula in these documents going back more than 100 years that encyclicals are addressed to all people of goodwill, which means everybody, right? Everybody of any religion. But Pope Francis has really expanded who he's trying to address these to by being really thoughtful about when he uses Christian framings and Christian stories, by including a prayer to God the Creator, so a prayer that can be used by anyone of any theistic faith. Yep. I noticed in this encyclical that he says, it's a very modest framing where he says, I'm writing this out of the Christian faith that animates me, but I really hope that anybody will take it and pay attention to it. So that's the hope. So what he is doing in this encyclical is looking at the world of 2020, and just as you said, starting before the pandemic, but very much taking that into account, diagnosing problems, and then setting out this vision of shared human, I would prefer to say familial love, right? The word fraternity in English is not so great, right? That's what's given as the title. Shared human familial love, which really means love for the other in their particularity, right? Love across difference.
And so, I know a lot of women were offended because of the title, because it says men, it implies men. It doesn't include the word women. I know that, you know, obviously he did not touch on gay issues. He did not even, I don't think, really touch on abortion. He touched on life. you know, on the idea of protecting life and the death penalty and whatever. But I looked at one of the things that he had written, and I saw an AP News story. And the Pope says, market capitalism has failed in pandemic, needs reform. And I read this and I'm like, Bernie Sanders, you gotta call the Pope. It's not that he embraced socialism per se or big government responses, but a lot of what he said, I felt like I could have read it in the Democratic policy platform. I felt like I could have read it because, you know, Bernie Sanders would have done it. But there was one thing he did, and I want you to explain how important this is, because for me, it made my heart swell. My husband died, but he was raised a Catholic. He was actually being groomed to be a priest. And he did not become a priest, but he did get married and had children. And he eventually left the church because he was so appalled at the intolerance of the church, that he didn't want his children raised in this intolerant setting. And not only did he leave the church, but he left faith completely. All right, so I married a Republican libertarian atheist. Now, talk about being the opposite of me. That's who I married. But the reason I bring this up is that one of the more remarkable things in his encyclical was when he talks about the human fraternity and about the relationship between Catholics and Muslims. Mm. Would you explain to my audience? I was over the moon. Because as you point out, it's sort of like a state of the union. But what he did was sort of acknowledge pluralism and diversity of religions, suggesting that there are many ways to God.
Yep,
and
exactly.
For a lot of Catholics and Protestants, that is unheard of. You know, you believe in Jesus and you shall attain eternal life, and that's the only way to God. But the Pope, mm-hmm. in the encyclical, talks about pluralism and diversity of religions. And I'm screaming up in the heavens. I'm not sure where my husband is. And I said, you can come back.
Oh,
because, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because it was a level of tolerance that was so important, I think. At a time where we need to bring us together, this document is so hopeful.
Mm-hmm. This is not a new teaching of the Catholic Church, but for whatever reason, there are many teachings like the teaching on property, which I hope we'll also get to, that just need to be said again and again, because we, not meaning Catholics, everybody, right? We struggle to hear them. And certainly the teaching on the dignity and truth to be found in all religions is one of those. So the church has been saying this since the 60s, right? All religions worship the same God. The church rejects nothing that's true and holy in these religions. But you're seeing something real here. I think that Francis is trying to not just say that, but really model it, because he keeps talking about the wonderful friendship and conversation that he had with the Grand Imam Al-Tayeb and what they learned in their dialogue together, what they want to bring forward in this conversation they had last year. And so the part of the vision he's setting out for familial love for all people is, like I said, love in particularity, that to hold a dialogue that lets me be me and you be you, and doesn't try to collapse us, but says that's okay that you're you and I'm me, but believes that we can talk together and that we both as humans have capacity to see the truth and move forward toward it.
It's so interesting that he did this. I don't know whether he knew this, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg just recently died. And I'm sure he knew this. But when you ask Ruth Bader Ginsburg about what she thought about sort of gender equality, she referenced Free to Be You and Me by Marlo Thomas. I swear to God, that's what she used. Okay, that to her was the definition of equality. And as I'm reading the language in his encyclical, I'm hearing Marlo Thomas saying free to be you and me. And I'm thinking, God, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Pope need to have a conversation, because it was so powerful. But the other thing he seemed to address, especially now because of the pandemic, is that free market capitalism isn't the solution. Mm-hmm. And now more than ever, we have seen the failure of this form of capitalism, that trickle down doesn't work, that this whole idea is actually a grotesque failure. So let's talk about him and capitalism and property, because in a lot of ways, if you look at America and you look at Donald Trump sort of, you know, threads himself about ownership and capital and acquisition. And this is almost, I'm not saying he did this politically, but it's almost a rejection and a message to his Catholic followers that, you know what Donald Trump embraces does not really represent what is good about our faith and what it is that we are taught to believe.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and again, the teaching on how the economy should work in human life, this is something the church has been doing forever. And Pope Francis isn't even the first to be looking at inequality specifically and calling that a problem, right? That would be Benedict. Yes. So they really are picking up on it at the same time many secular observers are. But yeah, I agree. Francis is calling it out very strongly. He talks about trickle down as a dogma of neoliberal faith. So he's the guy who's in charge of the true faith, right? He's saying that this whole idea that, you know, making the rich richer will somehow help the poor is a faith. It's a belief. It's not proven by the facts. And of course, that's absolutely true.
And he's a scientist. I mean, let's mm-hmm. remember that as well. And that when you realize, I mean, again, I think of Donald Trump being anti-science. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a message in a bottle. It mm-hmm. really, really is. And one of the things I also sort of noticed from this encyclical is that while this is not an endorsement document, that's not what he does. He is sort of putting out sort of one of the tenets of faith and Catholicism. It is an appeal to his Catholics to use their conscience.
Yes.
That don't be swayed. See what's in front of you. Hear what's real. Look at the consequences of actions. And when you hear it and see it and taste it and feel it, don't deny your conscience from kicking in. You know, and that to me is so important. I was saying to Ken, I want to sit down with every Cuban American in Florida. You know, and say, I understand what you're afraid of, you know, the socialists that you keep hearing about with Joe Biden. But if you read what the Pope is saying seems to be almost the opposite of what is being preached in the White House.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you're totally right. So an encyclical is not addressed to any particular person or even any particular country, right? Because a lot of these themes, inequality, xenophobia, nationalism, right? They feel so urgent to us in the US, but they're increasing problems in many countries. But as you say, if the shoe fits, right? If we are seeing this going on, we're observing in honesty. Every person, whatever their faith, has the ability to consult their conscience on that. And that's exactly what this can help us do.
So he can't do what he loves. A little bit like Donald Trump. He's caged in the Vatican. And like Donald, but unlike Donald, he feeds off the crowd. He needs them. And frankly, let's be honest, they need him. I mean, there's no question that he is an interesting figure. And it's not about elevating his ego. In a way, it's about being more humble.
Mm-hmm.
I see him wanting the crowds not to be above them, but to wash their feet.
Yep. Okay?
That he's such an interesting figure that way. And I'm wondering that at this time where he's sort of stuck in the Vatican, the way we're all stuck in our house, if that in some ways shrinks his ability to be heard, because so much of his hearing is not just his writing and it's not just his voice, it's how he is physically present with young people and crowds and traveling around the world and going to places where no Catholic Pope has ever gone before and spreading that universal message, not that only Catholic message, but it happens to be coming out of a Catholic Pope, but it can be received by anyone.
Yes, the gesture that teaches, he's a master of that. And I think you're absolutely right. One of his first actions of Pope was to literally wash the feet of a group of people who were young people of all faiths, all genders. And I remember I had like queer atheist friends on Facebook saying, I like this Pope. And I was like, wow, you know, I never thought I would hear that in my lifetime. So he is curtailed in something that is such a great teaching ability of his. And he wrote about that in the encyclical a little bit. He has this paragraph that's a little funny about how digital communication, we're not really accessing the physical gestures and even the blushes and perspiration of the other person. I mean, it's kind of funny. But as a teacher, I can tell so much more about my students, what they're learning when I'm in the room with them than when we're on Zoom like we are now. You know, their body language and so much of that knowledge and relationship is cut off. Encounter is a word he uses all the time in all of his encyclicals, which means, you know, a true exchange with another person who's different than you. And it's quite clear that he never envisions this taking place digitally, right? Encounter is when you're with another person, maybe on their turf, right? Trying to reach out to them. And so many of us have lost that.
Well, and so Kate, I always look at what I did politically and what I thought I was going to be doing as a minister was that I was setting a table. And when you set a table, you don't do it digitally. Because you set the table so people can be near you, so you can feed them, so you can see what makes them smile. And it requires that contact and that relationship that we can't have with social media. So since you're a teacher, I'm going to share something that will help you as you describe this piece of the encyclical. So I used to be on a conservative radio station. Ken has maybe heard me tell the story before. And this is like, I don't know, 10 years ago, you know, before social media became so overwhelming. But it was at the very beginning. And so this psychiatrist on the air, she's like a Dr. Joy Brown, I think her name was. Some guy was calling in and talking about this incredible, intimate sexual relationship he was having online, okay? I mean, he was going on and on and on about this. And I'm happy to be driving in listening to this because it was my station. And she stops him and she says, "You're not having a sexual relationship. Frankly, you're not having a relationship. You're typing." "We're typing." I have never forgotten that, because she was right. And what the Pope was writing in his encyclical was reminding us that typing can't replace relationship, that social media doesn't bring about the human contact that we so desperately, desperately need. And when this pandemic is over, the idea that we could all work remote is not really a solution, because what are we going to be missing with the typing that we would be getting if we were actually together?
Mm-hmm. I think we're all really recognizing something that we talk about in Christian theology, which is that we're embodied, right? We're not just sort of brains in a jar. Our body is part of who we are. It gives us a lot of knowledge. It gives us the ability to express ourselves. And so many human rituals that we have intuitively acknowledge that, right? Like, everybody always complains, why is there always food at the work meeting? Oh, I don't want these calories, you know, and things. But as humans, we get that eating together is a safe space. It's a place of connection. And people are going to make their own choices about these things. But there's a value to that. And there's a realness to that, that we really notice once it's taken away.
And, you know, I was talking to the kindergarten teacher the other day, and she'd been Zooming kindergarten. And finally, Monday was the first day they had real in-person class. And she said, "Arnie, Zooming couldn't work because the whole purpose of kindergarten is socialization."
Yeah.
And there is no socialization when you're on Zoom. It just doesn't work. And that's another reason I think I so admired what the Pope was willing to thread together. That's the other thing. This document is overwhelming because it isn't a soundbite.
Yes.
You can't tweet out the encyclical. Thank God. You know, because it doesn't have a number of characters, because he recognizes the complexity of life.
Yes.
And in a way, this encyclical reflects that complexity and actually celebrates it, and also understands the kind of challenge that happens because it is so complex. So is this his last encyclical? That's what people keep saying. Do you believe that?
Wow, I hadn't heard that. I hope not. I hope he, when you were saying that you wanted him to have a conversation with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I was like, not yet. I hope he lives for many more years. Yeah, I don't know if there's kind of a timeline on this or if he had.
You write them every year? How often do you write an encyclical? Well, see, that's my point.
Yeah.
An encyclical, a State of the Union is every year, okay?
Right.
So we always know you mail it in, you know it's going to happen. When do you decide to do an encyclical? What is the motivation for an encyclical? And how many encyclicals have been done by other popes? Is this the norm, three? Have some been, you know, prolific and done a lot of them? I'm kind of curious as to how you make the decision that now is the time.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's probably different for everyone. Yeah, it's not on a yearly schedule. There's no sort of... I could almost guarantee that John Paul II has written the most just because he had such a long papacy. I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, I think they come along when a pope wants to address something, you know, when he sees something going on in the world. Typically a new pope will bring one out pretty soon as sort of a position statement, right? And Pope Francis's first solo authored document was a level of slightly less formality that's called an apostolic exhortation, not an encyclical. But that was Evangelii Gaudium, where he introduced the image of encounter, which has become so foundational for him. He really talked a lot about inequality as a big concern. And the idea of encounter is meeting someone where they are, which is just kind of an image of his papacy in a nutshell.
So I mentioned the idea that the Pope appeals to conscience. Mm. And I don't know if you had a chance to read the Guardian newspaper. And of course, the Guardian is going to read the encyclical through the Guardian's lens. But they wrote, how Pope Francis's encyclical could shake up the U.S. election. That's what the opinion piece is about. And what I want to share with you before I let you go is her last paragraph, okay? Because this is the one that I was like, take your smile off your face, Arnie. Fratelli tutti will make for awkward reading for Trump and his gun-toting pro-electric chair supporters, including prominent Catholic Attorney General William Barr, who reintroduced federal executions for the first time since 2003. Yet it will also be tricky for Biden and the large constituency of Catholic Democrats who have compromised on abortion. In that sense, Fratelli Tutti cannot be classified as giving a wholesale papal imprimatur to Biden. But for those Catholics still thinking of casting their ballot for Trump, it should inspire them to question what Pope Francis would surely say is the most precious thing they possess, their conscience. Mm-hmm. This clarion call from across the Atlantic could be an election clincher. And I read that, and coming from a Catholic family, my great uncle was the Monsignor of Naples, Italy. So when we came to visit him and we were not Catholic, he went, so you're the ones, you know, understanding what this is and married to someone who really was so immersed in the faith and then left it. I look at what he wrote as being such a powerful document of inclusion and almost like a welcome mat to the world at a time that the world feels so divided, Kate. We are fighting each other. We are fighting countries. We are fighting based on wealth. We're fighting based on gender. We're fighting based on color. And what he tried to do was provide a way to give you a roadmap of how we can find each other again. And we need this. And I'm so sad that no one's really talking about it, but I'm so glad he wrote it now. And I'm so glad that we found Kate Ward to help us.
Well, thank you very much. It's a beautiful image of what we can be.
It is a beautiful image of what we can be. Kate Ward started out for AFSCME being a union organizer. Do I love her? And now she teaches at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is why I mentioned my time in Wisconsin. And she teaches everything that has to do with ethics. So if I ever have an ethical question, Kate Ward, trust me, I know exactly who I'm going to dial up. And it's going to have you, your name at the other end of the phone. And thank you very much for joining us. And good luck with your students. Are you doing it online or in person in Marquette?
We're a mix. I'm able to teach online right now, so I'm grateful for that. You know, some of our teachers are in the classroom. It's very complicated no matter what situation you're in.
And I know Wisconsin right now is almost an epicenter of an increase in COVID cases.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to beg you to stay healthy. All right.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
Ask you a question, Kate. Yesterday, we had on the show John Nichols, who writes for The Nation, and he was talking about how the Democrats and Biden in particular need to talk about the issues that Trump labels socialist, but that the American people don't want to hear them called socialist, that America believes in rugged individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him that I thought that the way to frame these progressive issues is not so much as rugged individualism, but why not the way Jesus preached in the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, I'm Jewish, I'm not particularly religious, but the idea of loving your neighbor as yourself and welcoming the stranger and treating everybody with respect and dignity, I mean, those are the kinds of progressive values that really should be the underlying message, I think, from the Democratic Party, any party, progressives. You don't have to think of them as socialist. I mean, who cares what you call them? But I think it's more, it would connect more with real live American people, because people value religion and they want to do the right thing. People are basically good. So I was wondering what you think of that religious, not really religious, but humanitarian, spiritual underpinning.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. You're right on that reflects Christian values. I would think it would be successful. I don't know how good I am at reading, you know, the pulse of the U.S. electorate. But honestly, I think the Democratic Party is not that good at connecting with people of faith and using faith framings. There was a little story that came from, I think, the Obama administration, you all might know, where they wanted to title a report on poverty, The Least of These. And somebody said, what's that mean? I don't know what that sounds like. Get rid of that. And I think about that once a week. I seriously do. And there are so many, you know, Arnie, you're one of them, right? People who are more lefty in their politics, who can speak the language of faith and who have these skills. It's a big frustration.
I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah,
I'm not
right,
afraid of
exactly.
It. I always said to my friends, you know, that if you embrace faith, it's not your Achilles heel, it's your hammer. Mm-hmm. Don't run away from who you are. Don't run away from your values. Celebrate your values. And in a lot of ways, your positive, your sense of well-being and your vision, it's infectious.
Yeah. Look at AOC. AOC does that so beautifully. She's a person of faith. She has the values that she has. She can connect them.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's her strength. Kate White, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing more insight into this encyclical. And if he writes another one, we'll call you. But if we have an ethics question, we'll call you, which means probably in 2 hours. So take care of yourself. Thank you so
much. Lovely. Oh, a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Hey, nice talking to you.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. This little light of mine, I'm